Writer Alan Bennett feeds a sheet of paper into a manual typewriter. Wearing a safety helmet, Alan rides a lime green tricycle along a quiet city street. Bespectacled Alan, in his early 90s, wears a brown jacket over a shirt and tie. As he cycles slowly, he passes people walking dogs on leashes along tree-lined streets. A framed portrait of Alan with a mane of fair hair hanging on a yellow-painted wall, a shelf full of his books, then a green folder labelled Bennett Family Photos. Alan's fingers striking the typewriter keys, bookshelves crammed with volumes, then an A to Z of Leeds and Bradford. He reads from pages in his hand.
Two things one seldom hears about getting older. One's ears get larger and one's dick gets smaller. Most distressing is to find not only one is old, but like all the other old people. At 60, one is an individual still. At 90, one is a cliché.
Now, Alan's outside walking with a stick. He's assisted by a silver-haired man in his late 50s who holds his arm as they stroll along. On the surface of rippling water, shimmering in the moonlight, a floating bottle with Arena in glowing pink script along the side. Typewritten pages.
These are just...
That's the list of the clips, I think.
The thing I'd quite like to include... Oh.
Actually, do you see it, Alan?
I can't see it, but I can't read my own writing. Oh. I've arrived at 90, feeling every minute of it. The trouble is, I'm rewriting it as I'm reading it. And then I dry up. Oh, I'm sorry, anyway.
Alan Bennett, 90 years on. Footage of a younger Alan on a TV studio set, seated beside an interviewer.
He is, of course, one of the original Beyond the Fringe quartet. He taught history at Oxford and is, according to his own admission, an awful person to interview. Alan Bennett.
Alan types a sentence beginning, having arrived, on paper.
Having arrived, slightly to my surprise, at my 90th year, I wasn't unduly dismayed because, despite its infirmities, it would give me an opportunity to sum up, set out what I've learned, in a word, pronounce. But what? Not much. I seem to have learned nothing, except perhaps the importance of luck. The two biggest strokes of luck in my life were meeting my partner, Rupert Thomas, and working almost exclusively with another surprise encounter, Nicholas Heitner.
A film crew's outside a stone building with arch windows. Alan seated among the crew. His silver-haired companion, his partner Rupert, places headphones over Alan's ears.
Rupert and I have been invited to visit the set of a new film that I wrote before COVID, and then it was put off and I despaired of it being produced. But it has been produced and been filmed this last month, and it's called The Choral. It takes place in 1916. And it's about a choral society in a northern town. It's being directed by Nicholas Heitner.
On a monitor, scenes from various films scripted by Alan.
I seldom watch my own stuff once it's been shown on television or in the cinema, but I agreed to do so for the purposes of this film, though it meant looking back over more than 60 years.
I've started umpteen plays that never get any further. Plays
that don't get written. I said, well, you're number one with me too. Give me your teeth, I'll swill them.
I don't see how we can do it like that.
We don't have to say much about them.
Yes. I'm sorry to be so self-conscious. I don't know, having exposed my own incompetence, I don't know what I can do.
Beyond the Fringe, 1964.
With the original cast of Alan Bennett, Peter Cook, Jonathan Miller, and Dudley Moore.
Peter was the person who could just instantly write, because he could improvise endlessly. I mean, he couldn't help but do it. John Bird said that it was a disease he had.
Perkins?
Sir?
I want you to lay down your life.
Yes, sir.
We need a futile gesture at this stage.
Jonathan was recycling a lot of old Footlights stuff, which he'd done at Cambridge.
Dudley Moore plays a piano.
Dudley, rather glumly, said he was the musician and we were all thought in words, obviously, and didn't think much of music. But, in a way, he was the most talented.
Just some of the few to whom all of us owe so much.
Suddenly, Jerry was coming at me out of a bank of cloud. I let him have it, and I think I must have got him in the wing because he spiraled past me out of control.
What I remember of that is I used to sort of do an imitation of Douglas Bader, the legless air ace. And I used to stump down the steps, stiff-legged, and people used to hiss.
I had a pretty quiet war, really. I was one of the few.
I thought I was somehow pushing the boundaries of, I suppose, satire, I thought. But it wasn't that. I just wanted to make a mark.
Please, sir, I want to join the few.
I'm sorry, there are far too many.
We weren't well-suited to one another, really. When I started to write on my own, it was a great release.
Is it very competitive?
If you're a comedian, that makes you competitive. Competitive is making the audience laugh. And who makes the audience laugh most, that's what the competition's about.
A curtain falls on the four performers while their audience applauds.
I believe you should let people praise you. It's part of the performance. I've never been very good at this, and this has been misconstrued as modesty. It's not modesty. It's more like incompetence.
You must have known from Beyond the Fringe that you were funny, that people laughed. You can't have been lacking
in confidence. Yeah, except that... it's what people, I mean, even the sort of favourable reviews say, has he got the range to do it? And so, well, I don't, it's probably quite true, I don't have, except that I don't know that one does have the range.
But would you say in general that...
I'm fucking incomprehensible how that is.
But
it's
not only
that,
until the initial idea comes.
Sort of my face is bony and miserable and sort of, you just can't do anything with it. You can't hide it, it's there.
Ridiculous, everything. I was so apologetic and nervous and fiddling about. Anyway.
On TV, the younger Alan sits with one clenched hand pressed against his mouth. In the present, Alan ties his striped tie below his shirt collar in front of a mirror. Then he looks at a handful of black and white photos of his younger self, sporting a jacket, shirt and tie.
I'm sometimes accused of always wearing the same clothes. The outfit I've pretty much worn since I was an undergraduate. I don't dispute this, with the tie in particular, something of a fixture. It's a school tie, though not my school, as it comes from Age Concern, the charity shop in the marketplace in Settle. It's probably a public school sports tie. I know it's from a private sector because on the inside of the tie is a cashier's name tape. with its one-time owner's name. The name is Justice. I'd like to think it's not inappropriate.
On a stage, teenage boys in school uniform form lines singing 40 Years On, BBC 1968.
Albion House School, the setting for 40 Years On, a play which opened in London this week at the Apollo Theatre. The author is Alan Bennett. 40 Years On is the first full-length production that is written for the theatre, and he appears in it himself.
Finding myself at this advanced age, expected to report, is not all that different from the position I'm often in as a playwright, looking for a memorable ending to a play. Perhaps my most notable ending was of my first play, 40 Years On, which I was lucky enough to star John Gielgud.
That was my first term as a schoolboy at Albion House. I can see now the faces of some of my schoolfellows on that never-to-be-forgotten November morning. Many of them sons of old boys who, proud trees for the felling, fell in that war.
The epilogue to 40 Years On is self-consciously poetic, but not unmemorable. A butterfly is an event, and were we close to the ground as children, or is the grass emptier now, also says a great deal, and it's quite a prophetic speech.
The hedges come down from the silent fields. A butterfly is an event.
Were we closer to the ground as children, or is the grass emptier now?
Once we had a romantic and old-fashioned conception of honour, of patriotism, chivalry and duty. But it was a duty which didn't have much to do with justice, with social justice anyway. The crowd has found the door into the secret garden. Now they will tear up the flowers by the roots, strip the borders, and strew them with paper and broken bottles.
A house with a sunlit lawn enclosed by trees and a dry stone wall. Alan reads from typewritten pages.
Yorkshire. These days, the county is enjoying a bit of a vogue, which, since I was born and brought up here, I find slightly insufferable. The e-bag gum side, I bet I always sound a bit of a bore. What I think of as Yorkshire speech is a much more old-fashioned way of talking. My father, if you'd lost something and wanted to know where it was, he would say, "I'll ascertain."
Two men walk past a shop in a quiet rural street.
Also characteristic of Yorkshire is a grudging of credit. And when credit is conceded, it's often backwards. That's not a bad-looking woman. And he's bright enough. It's a negative way of saying something positive.
Do you do it, Alan?
I suppose I do, but I don't notice it. I tend to negativise a lot of things. I don't know.
A fireplace with a guard.
I used to get coal when you were allowed to have coal from our coal merchant, Mr. Redhead, who was in the next village. And I rang him one morning and said, "Mr. Redhead, it's Alan Bennett." "Oh, I am conversing with higher beings." I said, "You said that last time I rang you." "I know, and I reiterate it." It's a slightly ironic way of talking, which is, in the nicest possible way, slightly taking the piss.
A Day Out, directed by Stephen Frears, BBC, 1972.
Oh, bye!
Breathe in, it's a grand country smell, is this? It fair does you good.
A Day Out, my first television film, is about a men's cycling club in Yorkshire on the eve of the First World War.
Nation. Never mind, it's good clean muck.
My missus doesn't distinguish between sorts of muck, Mr. Ackroyd. Muck is muck to her, and it's anathema.
It was shot in very, very cold weather. It was May, but it was more like February.
Here we are. Journey's End.
Isn't that a picture?
I know one thing, my bum's numb.
I laughed not at the joke, but the fact that Paul Cheyne was one of the cyclists. He had to say, "My bum's numb." He couldn't say it. And I, because I was quite early on in my career, I didn't know you should never tell an actor how it, give a reading to them. You should coax them towards it. But I couldn't get him to say it right. And so he says on the film, "My bum's numb," meaning that the possibility of other parts of his anatomy being numb.
In a scene from the television film, a group of men climb the steps of an imposing monument.
A Day Out ends with the war memorial in 1919, with the surviving members of the cycling club, the others obviously having been killed in the war.
The ruins of a stone abbey in sunshine under a blue sky, then a scene from the black and white television film with actors inside the same building.
The film was partly shot at Fountains Abbey.
The fellow that laid them stones knew what he were doing.
He'd be a monk.
I saw Fountains when I was, I think, 8, because we were evacuated, sort of, to Wilshill, near Pateley Bridge, which is not far from Fountains. And I went there with my mum.
The History Boys, directed by Nicholas Heitner, 2006.
But Fountains is an extraordinary place. I've shot at least 3 films there, and I always delight in going there because you're filming, there's nobody else there, and it's such a treat.
All male community, was it, sir?
Of course, they were monks.
Bit of that, you think?
The History Boys is about a group of grammar school pupils trying to get into Oxford or Cambridge. The film itself has become famous because many of the young actors in it have since gone on to distinguished careers.
A group of older teenage boys in uniform rush into a classroom where their teacher, Hector, addresses them.
Où voudriez-vous travailler cet après-midi?
Je voudrais travailler dans une maison de passe.
Oh là là!
Dans une maison de passe?
A brothel.
Ah, yeah. I didn't know whether it would work, it all being in cod French, so I was quite gratified that it did.
Oui, la prostituée, s'il vous plaît.
One boy's taken his trousers off. He lies across 2 desks.
À quel prix?
10 francs.
10 francs. Pour 10 francs, je peux vous montrer ma prodigieuse poitrine.
I'm competitive, envious, and I take pleasure in the achievements of my contemporaries only if they're in a different game. I've never entirely given up wanting to be someone else, and it's what has spurred me on.
Do you look at your life, sir? I thought everybody did. I'm a Jew. I'm small, I'm homosexual, and I live in Sheffield. I'm fucked.
In the History Boys, it was generally assumed that I identified with Posner, gay, scrawny, and unhappy.
Rog?
Rather, I identified with Rog, not unhappy, who tells Mrs. Lintott, his teacher, that he's glad to have got in at Oxford because that was what his fellows wanted, and so he wanted it too. That's me.
I only wanted it because the others did, and my dad. Now that I've got in, I just feel like telling the college to stuff it.
Rudge walks off down a corridor, leaving his teacher looking disappointed.
One of my life's proudest moments came in 1957. When I was rolling barrels in the cellars of Tetley's Brewery in Leeds. My parents turned up with my exam results from Oxford, a postcard saying that I got a first. My mother said, "Does it mean you've come top?" Which was no surprise to her, as that was what I'd always done ever since elementary school. Not quite, but near enough. She gave me a kiss. Dad said nothing, thinking, I imagine, the time would tell, which I suppose at 90 it has.
A mantelpiece filled with ornaments, one a wooden penguin on wheels, a dish inscribed with The History Boys by Alan Bennett. What a lovely film. Alan looks through black and white photos of his younger self with another boy.
That's Gordon and me. Photographed by a photographer called Lonergan's in Leeds. But he's 3 years older than me.
Have a joint birthdays?
No, we didn't really make much of birthdays, really.
I was conceived in a strange bedroom. My birthday, like my brother's, is in May. And though 3 years separate us, we were both born on the same date. Counting back the months, I realised we must both have been conceived during the old August bank holiday, in a boarding house bedroom in Morecambe or Flamborough or Filey. Nowhere like this, anyway. Harrogate, where hotels abound and always have.
The Can Hotel, good morning, how may I help you?
Dinner at noon, 1988, the Crown Hotel in Harrogate. In the present day, Alan and Rupert walk through a hotel dining room.
The filming today is happening in the Crown Hotel in Harrogate.
Yeah, great.
Which I got to know when, in 1988, I made a BBC documentary about it called Dinner at Noon. What happened was the BBC asked me to do a documentary on a hotel and I didn't really take that on board, really. I didn't think of what I wanted to do. And then as it got nearer, I panicked, really, and wrote some snippets about my parents, about growing up and about having meals out with them and how embarrassing it was. And then when we got here, we fitted those into the background of the hotel.
Alan's on a sofa beside a table bearing a tea tray.
My parents like this side of hotel life, and they would have liked this kind of hotel. Weddings, dinner dances, functions galore. Not that there'd ever be anything in which they'd dream of participating. Only there'd be more to see.
They weren't used to hotels. They regarded them as the lap of luxury. They didn't feel that they belonged there or that they had any right to be there, really.
When we were at home, we always had our dinner at lunchtime. And for my parents, anything that came after that was never more than a snack. So that when I was at university and they came to see me, we'd go into the hotel dining room at night and the waiter would present the menu. And my mum would say the dread words, "You do a poached egg on toast." And we'd slink from the dining room. The only family in England not to have its dinner at night.
Oh, well, of course they're dead now, but I grew much less self-conscious about them as I got older and rather revelled in the fact that they were so stuck to the way they'd been brought up, really.
In the film, a younger Alan leaves the hotel via a revolving door. A dry stone wall stretches across green countryside below rolling wooded hills. Alan reads from his work.
Ariel Crittall, a grand 80-year-old lady, said, "What is it I don't have to do now that I'm 80? Oh, I remember. Tell the truth. Sorry. She also said, wear knickers, but I don't think I want to say that.
Alan's bookshelves filled with his works and those of other authors. Alan seated on a rail-back chair in front of a table with his typewriter on. He picks up a pile of papers from the cluttered table and leafs through them.
Is it this one? There was another part here, Alan.
Yes, I think it's here. But it's here somewhere.
On a screen, Alan appears in Talking Heads, A Chip in the Sugar, BBC 1988. His character wears a jumper over a shirt and tie.
I'd just taken a tea up this morning when she said, Graham, I think the world of you. I said, I think the world of you. She said, that's all right then. I said, what's brought this on? She said, nothing. This tea looks strong. Pull the curtains.
I can say nothing about Talking Heads and take refuge in something I wrote later, The History Boys, in which one of the boys protests to his teacher, who had dared to say, in other words, about a poem. With respect, sir, with a poem, it's a work of art. You can never say, in other words. If it's a work of art, there are no other words. You can't look at a Rembrandt and say, in other words, without claiming it's a masterpiece. If I'd anything more to add to Talking Heads, I would have done it at the time. Too late now.
Well, that's a warning for you.
Why?
I can't talk to you about Talking Heads.
Well,
nothing more to say.
Well, it is true. There's nothing I can add, really, that isn't in the things themselves. That was not meant to put you off.
I was all right on the Monday. I was all right on the Tuesday. I was all right on the Wednesday until lunchtime, at which point all my nice little routine went out of the window.
A woman of no importance.
The Talking Heads monologues began as a play called A Woman of No Importance. It's of a woman dying. Pat was very nervous about it because she said it was radio, not television. But anyway, we persisted and she took it on and had a great success with it.
He said, you're single. I said, yes. He said, where are your parents? I said, mother's in her grave and father is in a sunshine home at Moortown. He said, do you feel bad about that? He didn't look more than 17. I said, no, not after the life he's lived. I saw him look at Dr. Copeland. Only he was toying with the calendar, sneaking a look at what next month's cactus was going to be. Then this youth said, what life did he lead? I said, a life that involves spending every other weekend at Carnforth with a blondified piece from the cosmetics counter of Timothy White and Taylor's. He said, is that a shoe shop? I said, you're thinking of Freeman, Hardy and Willis. It's a chemist's.
Other characters from the Talking Heads monologues.
And that emboldened me to do six more. The one I did myself and other funny women. The reason why they were all women, I think, was because when I was young, my dad wasn't much of a talker, whereas my mum had two sisters and they were talkers. And I was exposed to a great deal of feminine gossip and talk, and that went in, I suppose.
A bed among the lentils.
Geoffrey's bad enough, but I'm glad I wasn't married to Jesus.
They were called Talking Heads because in the television parlance of that day, if you showed anything for any length of time without a visual sugaring, really, a diversion. Somebody would say, oh, it's a bit talking heads, meaning that that was not interesting. Whereas it seemed to me when you got talking heads and got close in on a character, it was the most interesting thing.
Jodie Comer in Her Big Chance.
He said in an ideal world, Leslie, I'd be happy to sit chatting all day, but I have a very tight schedule, and although it's only 9:30 in the morning, can I see you in your bra and panties? I said 9:30 in the morning, 10:30 at night. We're both professionals, Simon. But, I said, can we put another bar on? Because if we don't, you won't be able to tell my tits from goose pimples.
An electric fire with one glowing bar. Now Thora Hird appears in Waiting for the Telegram, BBC 1998.
I saw this fella's What Do You Call It today. Oh, except I'm not supposed to say What Do You Call It. Verity says Farlet. What Do You Call It is banned. When we cannot find the word we want, we describe. We do not say, what do you call it? Well, you won't catch me describing that.
Thora was wonderful to work with. The last thing I did with her was Waiting for the Telegram, not long before she died. She said, I got the script, I looked at it, and I thought, well, I'm not going to swear for anybody else, but I'll swear for Alan Bennett. And I thought, well, that's a great tribute. And then I thought, well, I don't think there is any swearing in it. And then I realised what she meant was it mentioned penis. And that was swearing to Thora.
She says, Violet, I have to ask you this. Was the penis erect? I said, Nurse Babty, that's not a word I would use. She said, erect? I said, no, the other.
In Waiting for the Telegram, she remembers her sweetheart coming to see her on the eve of leaving for the trenches in the First War and hoping to sleep with her. To her lifetime's regret, she rejects him and weeps, remembering it.
And then he says, take your clothes off now.
Her lips tremble and she lowers her head.
And I didn't. I didn't. And I wanted him so much. I don't know, it was just the way I'd been brought up. And he stands there looking down at me. And then he picks his clothes up and he goes next door. And after a bit, I heard the front door bang. See, they look old in photographs compared with what they look now. Only they weren't. They were lads, same as you. And just as grand. I saw the yellow thing the boy on the bike brings. His sister fetched it round.
She wipes her nose with a handkerchief.
A telegram.
Outdoors, a life-size bronze statue of a First World War serviceman in uniform on an octagonal sandstone column. Alan reads from his typewritten papers, the script peppered with handwritten corrections and changes.
The monologue ended and there was a silence. The silence was because the cameramen were crying.
Alan flicks through a book, Beyond the Fringe.
When years ago we were in Beyond the Fringe, we used to do cabaret very often, and Peter and Dudley were always the stars. They always made the band laugh. I never did. But I thought in the studio, well, I never made the band laugh, but at least I made the cameraman cry.
The crew on the set of The Coral, Then Alan's sitting beside Rupert watching the filming.
I think I'm about to meet quite a few people, you know, in what I think, or what I thought writing was quite a funny scene.
A bit locked.
Thank you.
It's a scene in a tribunal for reviewing boys who are conscientiously objecting.
Quiet, please.
Rupert.
They are brilliantly well cast. They all look completely right, don't they?
The First World War serviceman statue on its column in a quiet rural square.
My mother's only brother was killed in the First War. It was always poignant. You would be referred to in the families, your Uncle Clarence. Uncle Clarence was, I suppose, 17 or 18. And he had a hernia. And this excused him military service because any operation at that time was risky. He eventually went into hospital and had the operation, and then 6 months later he was sent to the front and he was killed at Ypres in 1917.
The Abbey, directed by Jonathan Steedall, BBC 1995. Inside Westminster Abbey, a clergyman in a black cassock lights a candle. Then a group of visitors gathers around the tomb of the unknown soldier, the gravestone lined with poppies.
The notion of the tomb of an unknown warrior was that of David Railton, an army chaplain. The body was brought from France with elaborate precautions to ensure its anonymity and buried here, just inside the west door, on November the 11th, 1920. No one else had ever been buried at this spot, and digging down, they came straight away to the sand and gravel of Thorny Island. Then the coffin was put in and filled with soil that had been brought from the various battlefields in France. A precise reversal of the Rupert Brooke poem, "There'll be some corner of a foreign field that will be forever England." The corner of the foreign field is here.
On screen, Alan, then in his 60s, walks away from the tomb. In the present day, he looks at a black and white image of his younger self.
I count as education what little violence I've seen. There was violence, only verbal, in the square in basic training at Pontefract in Yorkshire, when the RSM of the York and Lancaster Regiment bawled me out an inch or so from my face. I can still feel the spit on my cheek. I'm lucky not to have seen anything worse. Except I'd forgotten the occasion when Rupert and I were ourselves attacked. I can't offhand recall the year, presumably because I was the object of the violence and not its observer. It was in Italy, a small seaside town not far from Rome, where, strolling one evening on the promenade, Rupert and I were attacked by some local youths. Lucky to escape with my life, my assailant hit me on the head with a scaffolding pole. In a life not overcrowded with incident, what galled me at the time was that everyone, the Italian doctors, the police, no one believed we had not been cruising. A sophistication neither of us indulged in or were capable of. The injustice of that assumption rankles and perhaps explains why I've never drawn on it other than to record it in my diary.
Prick up your ears, 1987.
That sounds like a terrifying encounter in Italy.
Well, it was. It was a fairly close call and we knew at the time it was, and there was blood streaming down my face.
But it was definitely homophobic. It wasn't just that they wanted to...
No, they didn't want it. They didn't want it. If they did, they didn't go the right way about asking for it. I mean, we'd probably have given them money rather than submit to this rubbish.
Prick Up Your Ears, starring Gary Oldman and Alfred Molina. Alan reads.
My stuttering exit from the closet has been played out in public, chronicled or implied in the course of umpteen plays and writings, with some less ambiguous than others.
This is a new experience for me.
Yes?
Television. I've never seen it before.
Do you like it?
This?
Television.
Two men are sitting on a bed together. Then the older man takes the younger man's trousers off.
It's the beginning of a new era.
Prick Up Your Ears is about the playwright Joe Alton, who was murdered by his lover Kenneth Halliwell in 1967. Joe Alton was a much funnier writer than I am, and a much better writer.
The older man undresses and gets into bed with the younger man.
Joe Alton and his lover Halliwell are often seen in bed together, but their hands are never below the blankets. It's very coy, and I feel I contributed to that without knowing it.
If he throws off his bedclothes, tears away his bandages, scratches as he soars, and if he does not strive every day and always towards his own recovery, then he must be restrained. I am the king of England, no sir! You are the patient!
The Madness of King George, directed by Nicholas Heitner, 1994. In a scene from the film, King George III, a florid-faced man in his 50s, is strapped into a chair. Then a man ties a gag around his mouth. As the king rides, his physician stands confronting him, while a line of soldiers wearing red coats and holding weapons look on. Alan reads.
We still don't really know why King George III went mad, but his illness and the shocking treatments prescribed by his doctors were documented at the time in minute detail.
Do you think that you're mad?
I don't know.
I knew very little about madness until my mother was struck down with depression. Doctors are very keen to tell you that depression isn't madness, but in many respects it mimics it.
Madness isn't such a torment. Madness isn't half blind. Madmen can stand. They skip, they dance. I talk. Talk and talk and talk.
So, in the film, the touching relationship between George III and Queen Charlotte is partly derived from watching my father. She was treated at the hospital locally, and my father would always be there on the stroke of 2 o'clock when it opened to visitors. I said to him, "You've no need to go as conscientiously as that." And he said, "Well, I have to go because your mama's lost herself, and I know where she is. I know what she is, and I have to be there when she begins to come back."
Sunset across the bay, BBC 1975. A silver-haired couple are passengers on a coach.
It's one of them buses with a lavatory. Are you going to go?
I don't want to go.
I do.
I'll go then.
I don't want everybody to know I'm going.
Sunset Across the Bay is about a couple, not unlike my parents, who move from Leeds to the seaside town of Morecambe.
All right. I'll be back.
The thing that strikes me about that is when she entrusts her bag to Dad. That was invariably used to happen with my mum. She was so frightened of putting a bag on the floor of the loo, thereby polluting it for all eternity, that she used to, when she went to the ladies, always said, "Dad, look after my bag, don't let anybody touch it," as if anybody would.
An engaged sign on a toilet door.
He would hold the bag and wait for her outside the ladies, but he wouldn't tuck it under his arm as she would. He'd hold it slightly to the side to indicate that he had nothing to do with this terrible object.
I went.
Yeah.
It's very ingenious. They've got it in above where they generally put the luggage. You want to go?
I don't want to go.
That's your trouble. No spirit of adventure.
I came to see that this business with the bag, there was evidence of his affection and love, really. And so I thought of it as a joke, but it wasn't.
Morecambe Bay.
Spend a lot of time in Morecambe as a child?
Well, it was the place Leeds people went for their holidays, and it always rained in my recollection. My brother and me would go on the sand if it was fit to go, but it very often wasn't. You dug 6 inches down and you came to black mud. It's not really a sandy place. But it was childhood, you know. Morecambe was where you went on holiday.
The Lady in the Van, directed by Nicholas Heitner, 2015.
Mr. Benny, where have you been?
Seeing my mother.
Oh, how is she?
The same. She doesn't remember me now.
Well, not surprised she doesn't see you very often. You write about her all the time, one way or another. You use your mother.
That's what writers do.
A photo of an elderly woman in a baseball cap.
Miss Shepherd lived in a van in my driveway for nearly 15 years, until her death in 1989.
In a scene from the film, a blue plaque's unveiled.
In The Lady in the Van, she's played by Maggie Smith. Alex Jennings plays me. And once again, the director was Nicholas Heitner. I was living in Primrose Hill, not far from the foot of the hill. And Jonathan Miller was also living just round the corner.
Shepherd.
Now, I'm a bit behindhand with things, so there may be a bit of a...
Put your arm around my neck.
Oh.
I felt sorry for the ambulance man because on the several occasions when she had to do with the ambulance men, they never showed any indication that she smelt disgusting. It required some effort to deal with her. Well, she looked almost human in that clip. She was normally never other than disobliging.
In another scene from the film, Miss Shepherd has decorated her yellow van with Union Jacks and pictures of Queen Elizabeth II. The actor playing Alan leaves his house, stops at the site, then walks on. On a sunny day, a green space with tree-lined lawns and the London skyline on the horizon.
In England, the past is quite heavy. We stagger under the burden of reminiscence. Lost should lost be and not found. It's over.
Snow falling on a poster in Russian.
I can say I love England. I can say I love Yorkshire. I can't say I love my country. I don't know what that means. I put those words into the mouth of Guy Burgess, the spy, in my play An Englishman Abroad.
An Englishman Abroad, starring Alan Bates and directed by John Schlesinger. BBC, 1983.
So little, England. Little music, little art. Timid, tasteful, nice. Yet one loves it. You see, I can say I love London. I can say I love England. I can't say I love my country. I don't know what that means.
Anthony Blunt says his friend Guy Burgess persuaded him to support the communists in the 30s as the best bulwark against fascism.
You claim that Guy Burgess recruited you as a Russian spy. Wasn't it the other way round?
No.
Who was the spy master then in Cambridge at that time?
No one. We all felt it was our duty to do what we could against fascism. And it was put to me by Guy. It was my duty to do this.
Buckingham Palace, A Question of Attribution, directed by John Schlesinger, BBC, 1991.
When Sir Anthony Blunt, the keeper of the Queen's pictures, was exposed as a Soviet spy in 1979, the dramatic ironies of the situation were immediately obvious. And I wrote the central scene of A Question of Attribution, in which Blunt and Her Majesty meet in Buckingham Palace.
Where are my papers? You're supposed to be holding the steps. I could have fallen flat on my face.
I think you already have.
Your Majesty.
I suppose that is part of your function, Sir Anthony, to prove that my pictures are fakes.
Well, because something is not what it is said to be, ma'am, doesn't mean that it's a fake. It may just have been wrongly attributed.
Yes. Though she never saw the play, Her Majesty may have seen the film, supposedly remarking, "Oh, no, she's not like me at all. She makes wisecracks. I never do that." But she did, and indeed about the play.
Civil Division, Miss Prunella Scales for services to the performing arts.
When Prunella Scales was being given the CBE, the Queen whispered, "I suppose you think you ought to be doing this. A laugh-out-loud wisecrack in anybody's books."
Now Alan's pedalling his tricycle along a quiet urban road. He rides slowly past the railings of a city park, then passes two red telephone boxes and a letterbox. A sign reading Primrose Hill Community Library, then in a window a poster, "Read a local author." Below it, on the sill, is a paperback, "Alleluia" by Alan Bennett.
In "Alleluia," my last play, the last speech is given to Dr. Valentine, an Asian doctor who came here as a young man to study medicine, but who outstayed his visa. So, though he is now a good and qualified practitioner, and English in all but name, he is an illegal.
A giant sign reads, "Anyone facilitating the settlement of Muslims or illegals in our areas will be held responsible. We are watching."
Why, I ask myself, should I still want to join? What is there for me here, where education is a privilege and nationality a boast? Starving the sick and neglecting the old. What makes you special still? There is nobody to touch you, but who wants to anymore? Open your arms, England, before it's too late.
A jostling crowd in a street, with a line of riot police standing against a wall bearing shields. Protesters let off smoke flares as they march along an urban road waving England flags. Alan leafs through his typewritten manuscript.
Mm. That's a pretty bleak view of Englishness.
Well, I think it's my view, really, now.
An England flag flutters from a stone tower. A waterfall cascades in the shade of leafy trees. Then fast-flowing river water washes over mossy rocks. A stone arch bridge over a country river, then people stroll along a sun-dappled rural road.
I'm anxious that this should not be my last word. Not because I've a great deal left to say. I'm not sure that I have. But I'm concerned that just because it's so late in the day, I have to drum up some sort of lesson from life. It's the sort of thing old men do.
In green countryside, a tractor ploughs a furrow through a field dotted with hay bales. Children play on swings and rustic climbing frames on a quiet green beside the stone church. Alan's seated on a wooden bench outdoors, his hands resting on his walking cane, a contemplative look on his face.
Kept skinny by involuntary clear-outs, I'm fearful of falling, which I've done once or twice. Thanks or no thanks to two hearing aids, I can eavesdrop on the workings of my own body. I can hear my stomach gurgle and my ankles groan, which I find disturbing, at one point mistaking it for creaking floorboards. Ageing, though, is not quite as the best literary authorities would have it. Samuel Beckett is known for looking life in the eye and sees getting old as drying up. Ageing is sanitised as desiccation, dry and dusty. But it's also prone to dissolution, often inconveniently so. Waiting for Godot would carry more credence if one of the characters cut short his runic wisdom and made a bolt for the bushes. It happens.
A group of bell ringers walk up steps into a church tower, then grasp the ropes.
Trouble's going. She's gone.
Wearing T-shirts, shorts and saddles, the bell ringers pull the ropes.
I think you're going to say it was...
And I'd like to thank her for good. I know what I'm going to say. On my 90th birthday in May, I was asked to walk up to the local church in Yorkshire where a surprise had been prepared for me. I sat down on the bench in the churchyard and the local team of bell ringers rang a peal of bells, especially for me. It was very beautiful, though rather loud, and I'd like to thank them for going to all that trouble. It wasn't an official gesture, but the bell ringer's own idea. I wanted to say, but the beekeeper's own idea.
Alan sits smiling on a churchyard bench.
Don't look so serious.